This is the Protestant Libertarian Podcast, a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute and part of the Christians for Liberty Network. I really hope that you guys enjoy today's show. All right, guys, welcome to another episode of the Protestant Libertarian Podcast. My guest today is, again, Lori Calhoun. She is a philosopher, a cultural critic, and an author. She is a senior fellow at the Libertarian Institute, where she regularly writes articles analyzing war and the military-industrial complex. Her books include We Kill Because We Can, which is about drone warfare, and the book which we will be discussing today, War and Delusion. Lori, welcome back to the Protestant Libertarian Podcast.
Hello, Alex.
So your work focuses on war and its consequences. When did you first start thinking about the morality of war?
This started right before the 1991 Gulf War. And I didn't really understand why George H.W. Bush was so keen on going to war in Iraq. And so I looked into the matter and I found out that Saddam Hussein had claimed that Kuwait was siphoning off oil from Iraqi territory. So that was his complaint and his excuse for having invaded Kuwait. So from my perspective, you know, this is a factual matter. You can like take disinterested parties to Kuwait, examine the site, and determine whether or not what he said is true. That's how you resolve this problem. If he's right, you ask Kuwait to stop doing it. And if he's wrong, you tell him he's wrong. But instead, George H.W. Bush was just gung-ho to have a war. And so my thinking was, how does bombing Iraq, filled with innocent people who have nothing to do with this conflict, constitute a moral or a just act? How is that supposed to, you know, mesh with our beliefs about the requirements of justice?
Yeah. And so your book, War and Delusion, was written in 2013, which was right in the middle of the United States war on terror. And again, very ambiguous war. A lot of the same problems that you alluded to with George H.W. Bush are some of the same problems we were seeing with George W. Bush during that time. What motivated you to write the book War and Delusion in the middle of the war on terror?
Well, what motivated me to publish it was probably in part what you just described, that we're in the midst of this complete quagmire of killing, a real orgy of killing. But I had been writing parts of it since 1999. I actually began writing essays on war on March 24th, 1999, when Bill Clinton began bombing Kosovo. And I wrote a whole slew of essays, basically trying to figure out why leaders such as Clinton and before him, George H.W. Bush, believed somehow that war was the solution to any of these foreign policy issues. So I wrote some very basic essays. I mean, basic from my perspective in terms of looking at the logic of warfare. Early on in 1999, I wrote an essay called The Injustice of Just Wars, where I again just basically went through the line of reasoning I just mentioned, which is that how does bombing a country filled with innocent people rectify an injustice committed by their leader, if in fact, you know, even if he did commit, you know, some sort of crime. And I wrote an essay called Critical Reasoning Regarding War, where I analyzed a whole list of fallacies involved in the sort of reasoning that is used to galvanize people to support wars. And I wrote an essay called Just War? Moral Soldiers? Where I just analyzed like basic concepts, you know, like in what sense is a soldier who goes out and follows orders obediently to kill anyone he is told to kill? In what sense is that a moral agent? So I wrote a whole slew of these essays, and then it just went on and on, you know, with 9/11 and the invasion of Afghanistan, and then the 2003 bogus pretext for the invasion of Iraq. I just kept writing more and more essays. So I ended up having this huge mass of essays, and I decided to turn them into a book. And so that's what War and Delusion actually is. I took all of my essays written to that point, threw them together, and organized it so that all of my arguments would be in one place. So it wasn't like I was, it wasn't as though I was just motivated in 2013. I was motivated to publish my findings as a result of about a 10-year process.
Yeah. So your book, War and Delusion, is a critique of the just war theory, which has had a very long standing in the Western tradition, ways in which people have tried to philosophically and even theologically justify the case for war. And at the very beginning of your book, you make the very obvious point that many wars are predicated on this idea that war is an act of self-defense. And certainly in my lifetime, all of the wars that the United States has waged overseas has been based on that notion that we're just defending our own interests and we have to launch these wars in order to protect ourselves from our enemies. What's the problem with the self-defense model of the just war theory? What's wrong with war as always being a form of self-defense?
Well, there are about 10 different fallacies committed in comparing personal self-defense to national self-defense. I mean, there are just so many things that are wrong with it, but I can give you a few examples. So, one is if we have a right to life, if we individual human beings, you know, conscious, sentient human beings have a right to life, does it follow from that a nation has a right to life? And that's an assumption that's often made, but it doesn't really work because nations are artifacts. First of all, nations have no personhood. They're not conscious. They're not sentient. They're not rational. They're none of the things that the individual people comprising them are. And it's also, so it's a fallacy of composition. You don't transfer your individual human rights to a nation state just because the nation state is filled with people who have human rights. So that's one fallacy of composition. And the example I use in the book is that, you know, you can say every member of the assembly is male. That doesn't mean that the assembly is male. So it's just it's a logical fallacy. It doesn't follow at all. Another problem is that nation states are artifacts. So you can take a group of people and just establish a nation state. And so then the mystery arises, how does it come to be that group of people can kill when no individual member of that group on his own is allowed to kill? So the first premise, you know, in reasoning about war is that it is wrong to kill people. So it's used as the pretext for going to war, but in fact, every time you go to war, you're actually going to kill people. So it's like a contradiction. And it's not a case of self-defense because none of the features of self-defense are present. So another example I give in the book is that if you think that your neighbor is suspicious for some reason, this does not justify you to go over to his house, enter his house, and slay him and anyone who happens to be around him. I mean, that's a really crazy idea, and we would never allow that as a justification for self-defense within civil society. So the question is, why do we allow our lawmakers, our politicians, to go to other countries and do that to other people and call it an act of national self-defense?
Yeah. And you go up from there, and in your second chapter, you actually outline what the just war theory entails. So before we get any further into the conversation, just explain what exactly encompasses the just war theory, because I feel like a lot of people were all raised in the Western tradition and we have this sense that there are times that war might be necessary. But mm-hmm. in your book, you outline exactly what it is that philosophers and users of just war rhetoric mean when they use that language. So could you outline the classical conception of the just war theory for us?
Sure. We still appeal to it when we want to go to war. When people want to go to war, they appeal to this framework. But it actually was drafted by Catholic theologians in the Middle Ages, beginning with Augustine, way, way, way back in like 400 AD. And then it was developed further by St. Thomas Aquinas later on in the Middle Ages. So the framework is designed to provide leaders with the ability to determine whether or not a prospective war would be a just war, whether or not they're justified in going to war. So there are two planks to it. One is jus ad bellum, justice in going to war, and one is jus in bello, which is justice in prosecuting or carrying out a war. So there's a bullet-pointed list of requirements that you're supposed to satisfy in order for your war to be said to be justly waged. So the jus ad bellum requirements include legitimate authority. It can only be waged by a legitimate authority. reasonable prospect for success. You can only wage a war if there's like a decent chance that you can actually win it. It has to be a last resort. You've exhausted all other nonviolent means to resolution of the conflict. It has to be proportional. You can't go have a bloodbath over a minor, you know, spat, over a minor dispute. Let's see. What are some other ones? Oh, public declaration. It has to be, you have to warn the enemy before you invade and kill them, you know, that they can resolve this peacefully in some other way by negotiating. And then once the war has been waged, there are these requirements of jus in bello, which you're supposed to follow in order to make sure that the war once waged is conducted justly. And these include proportionality. Again, you can't have a major bloodbath, you know, just like, you know, wipe out the entire population because of some minor, you know, border dispute, which is kind of, we can get to Ukraine later, but anyway.
Oh yeah, we'll get there.
Yeah, let's wipe out the entire planet, you know, because of a border dispute, you know, that was actually determined by a small group of men 30 years ago. It makes a lot of sense, you know, so that would be a classic case of disproportionality. Another one is, non-combatants are supposed to be immune from harm. So you don't target non-combatant civilians. They're not threatening you in any way. You're not supposed to be killing them. Another one, which has fallen to the wayside in recent years, is that you're not supposed to continue killing soldiers once they are no longer threatening to you. So if they're unarmed, for example, you take them prisoner, you don't then just execute them. Okay. And if they're unarmed, if they lay down their arms, they say, whoa, I give up. That's it. You know, I'm done. Then you don't subsequently murder them. Okay. So a good example of this happened in the first Iraq war when U.S. forces actually buried Iraqi soldiers in their trenches, and they killed Iraqi soldiers who were trying to just retreat and just, you know, surrender. So that would be a violation of the principle of jus in bello, according to which you're supposed to treat soldiers as fellow human beings, you know, with respect. And if they give up, then you're supposed to stop pursuing them. So those are the main planks. I mean, there have been lots of tweaks, bells and whistles added to these lists by scholars over the centuries. And what I argue in the book primarily is that this is not an apparatus which allows you to ascertain whether or not a war is just. It is rather an apparatus which allows leaders to rationalize the wars which they have already decided that they want to carry out. So it serves as a primer on how to develop motivational speeches for galvanizing your populace to get behind you for a war. That's how it's been used, in my view.
Yeah. Well, and that's a really, really important distinction. Before we get into the mechanics of that, you say in your book that the just war theory is based on essentially the assumptions of medieval Christian thought. And for a long time, you know, I have a, you know, my background is in theology and in biblical studies. Mm-hmm. And I, for a very long time, have had my skepticism towards Augustinian thought. Like, I'm not a fan of St. Augustine for many theological reasons. How much of the just war theory can be attributed to his thought in particular? And just kind of walk us through how the just war theory is really a reflection of the kind of the intellectual context of medieval Christendom.
Yeah, it's funny that it has survived. You know, we have vestiges, only thin vestiges of the culture of the Middle Ages. But this framework, this paradigm has survived because it's so successfully deployed to get people to support war. So there are major, major disparities between what we believe today and what St. Augustine believed, and also St. Thomas Aquinas, even if you're religious. Okay, so let's, you know, grant that you're religious, no problem. Okay, but the one major, major difference is that we no longer believe that our elected officials have power and authority in virtue of their direct connection to God. We don't believe that. Okay, so you can still believe in God, no problem. But you have to recognize that the way we look at politicians today is completely different from the way these Catholic theologians did. So their view was, you know, conservatively, you know, God's going to judge us in the end. But for now, just do what your leaders say because they have the wisdom that's been imparted to them by God. We don't believe that anymore. I mean, we know what our politicians are all about. They're a bunch of lying, conniving opportunists who yep. claw their way to the top. We know this. And yet, the minute they start dropping bombs, everyone lines up behind them as though they were somehow divinely inspired. So you saw George W. Bush talking about having conversations with God. Okay, you saw in 1999, one interesting point is that every leader on each side of every conflict always invokes God. Okay, so whether it's George W. Bush or Osama bin Laden, whether it's Saddam Hussein or George H.W. Bush, whether it's Adolf Hitler or the rest of the Western world, everyone invokes God. So God is just this card they play in the way that they play the just war theory. So since we believe that our politicians are fallible human beings, and we today, for the most part, I think, are closer to the Protestant, you know, Reformation view that we have, if anyone has access to the, you know, the will of God, all of us do. It's not just some small little committee inside a church somewhere or in a huge cathedral. We believe that the man on the street has just as much access to God as any leader. So that no longer holds anymore. So if you don't believe that, then the question is, why are you allowing this person who yesterday was just another, you know, civilian schmo walking around the street, why are you allowing him now to kill thousands of people? So that falls apart, you know, once you realize that we don't hold that view of leaders anymore. I think that these Catholic theologians were very intelligent, and they lived in a milieu where that was just accepted. You know, it was just like an accepted part of reality. I mean, you can always find examples in great scholars who were very intelligent, but because of where they lived and when they lived, they had, you know, a few odd views. Aristotle's another example. He thought that women were, you know, not full persons, but that's okay because he lived in a different place. Doesn't mean we have to invalidate every single thing he said. He had lots of good things to say too, but he was wrong about some stuff. And in the case of the just war theorists, they held this view of moral and legal authority, which we do not hold anymore. And so then the question is, why do we allow these leaders to continue to wage these wars that are actually causing so much harm to so many innocent people? And they do it on the pretext of protecting some of those people. It's, in a way, very crazy. A really stark example of this was in 1999. Bill Clinton was in the midst of this really sensational scandal involving Monica Lewinsky. And I don't want, you know, it may or may not have been a literal wag the dog situation, but the minute he started dropping bombs on Kosovo, all of that ended. No one talked about Monica Lewinsky anymore in the blue dress and all that nonsense. So no one talked about it because everyone decided we have to line up behind the commander in chief and support the war effort. So it's very, very powerful. And it's very deceptive in my view.
Yeah. Well, I have always just accepted the just war theory because I was brought up as a Christian and I was just taught that there were times that you had to go to war. That was the nature of reality. But it wasn't until about 4 or 5 years ago when I really started becoming skeptical of centralized power that I began to realize that a lot of what I had been told about war was very hollow. You spend the rest of your book kind of breaking down all of these different components of the just war theory. So I want to go through some of the major pieces of that theory that you address in your book. The first one, and you already kind of alluded to this, is that in every single war, both sides claim that they are in the right. Like, both sides claim to be waging a just war. How does that fact alone show the inconsistencies of the just war theory?
Yeah, it's really interesting because we have this almost childish tendency to assume that we are good and they are evil. Okay, so the minute our leader says, you know, there's a boogeyman, we got to go get him, then everyone sort of just goes along with it. So without thinking about the fact that the leader on the other side has a following because he says the analogous thing to his troops. So if you want to take our current example in Ukraine, we have Zelensky on the one side telling his soldiers that Russia is the evil guy. And then we have Putin on the other side saying that, you know, Zelensky's been bombing the Russian speaking people in the eastern parts of the Ukraine. So we got to do something about this. So we have this conflict between two leaders, each of whom claims to have justice on his side. And the soldiers are fighting under the interpretation of their commander in chief. Okay. So they're told they have to fight, you know, to the death because justice is what's at stake. And they're both told this on both sides. So one point I try to make in the book is that you could be just fortuitously born in the opposite place, in which case you would be fighting for the opposite leader because of what he told you. So the question is, do you ever have a reason to believe, you know, to fight for any of these people? Because they're all using the same framework, because it's very powerful. So that's one problem. I mean, the soldiers themselves, they're required by the military apparatus to follow orders. You know, in some cases in history, they've been executed for refusing to follow orders. And even in cases today where they fight for a dictator, they may be subject to execution. And so it raises this very, you know, important moral question. In what sense is it moral to go slaughter a bunch of, for example, Iraqi soldiers who have no choice but to fight for their dictator? So in what sense is that in any, you know, moral or just, you know, on top of all the civilian casualties that come with the war?
Yeah. We're also told by the media and by our political leaders that we have these great military planners that have all of these designs for war, and that when they engage in a conflict, they can plan exactly what's going to happen. And step by step, they're going to be able to unfold a war in exactly the way they want. Now, they can't do it with the economy, and they couldn't do it with COVID, but they tell us that they can do it with the war. And one of the points you make in your book is that war has all of these unforeseen consequences that often inevitably lead to more war. So how does that problem of unforeseen consequences result in there actually being more conflict later on down the road?
Okay, so yeah, this is part of the chapter where I discuss utilitarianism and consequences. So in the buildup to a war, everyone pretends like it's going to be short, we're going to be in and out. You know, Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction. We're going to get them and we're going to get out. Okay, yeah, 20 years later, here we are. The entire Middle East has been trashed. So they paint the war as this, you know, simple, short-term, temporary expedient that we have to engage in order to set things aright. Okay, but in reality, it's never that way. And what's really remarkable in the current circumstance is that we just left Afghanistan after 20 years of trying to kill the Taliban and insisting that they were the evil enemy, they were evil incarnate, they were the worst boogeyman on the planet. We walked out, leaving the Taliban in power. So then, you know, virtually the next day, we're involved in this heavy conflict between Ukraine and Russia. And no one stops to say, wait a minute, you actually just lost the war in Afghanistan. I mean, you just spent, trillions of dollars, I don't know how many exactly it was, in Afghanistan in particular, killed hundreds of thousands of people, caused the exodus of millions more, maimed and terrorized countless human beings all over the Middle East, just wrecked entire societies. And now look, the people you said could not be left in place are now running that country again. So where exactly did that money go to, and why are we allowing you to do this thing again? Because it looks to me like another meat grinder. We're putting a lot of arms in and a lot of money in, and what's happening is people are dying, and more people will die, and more people will die the longer and longer it goes on, just as happened in Afghanistan. And it's even worse in this case, as I mentioned earlier, because one of the parties to this dispute has nuclear arms. And should he lose, you know, his equanimity or suddenly decide that he doesn't care anymore, or he considers the implied threats that the CIA is going to assassinate him, if he starts to believe any of this, then he may just decide to launch a nuclear warhead. And if he does, then there will be a ricochet effect because of the setup during the Cold War of mutually assured destruction, and lots of people will die. So it's incredibly reckless to goad Putin. Whether or not you like him is irrelevant. He has nuclear arms. So that's like, you have to be practical here. It's not just a matter of, oh, you know, what would we do objectively? It's like, what is the smart thing to do in this case? And in this particular case, it's actually crazy to continue to provoke him.
Right. Right. Well, and that's what's so insane about that entire thing to talk about unforeseen consequences. It's not just that, you know, if Vladimir Putin was to launch a nuclear strike, this wouldn't just result in another war. This would result in the annihilation of millions and millions of people. So it's not, you know, it's not like the United States going in and kicking around, you know, the Iraqis or whatever, where there's no chance of like a large scale retaliation. Right. It's totally different level.
But it's like because they don't analyze their failures that they just plunder ahead with the next debacle. So no one stopped to analyze what happened in Afghanistan. Like, why were we there for 10 full years after Osama bin Laden was killed, right? Supposedly, yeah. We went there to find Osama bin Laden and the bad guys. All of the perpetrators of 9/11 were gone by then. You know, it was like May 31st, 2011. So why were we there for another 10 years? And what happened during that period, aside from just killing a bunch of more people and leaving Afghanistan actually worse off than it was, because now it's like riddled with corruption because of all right. the stuff that we did there. So, but the military, they don't. And this actually, I hate to say it, but it's a vestige of just war theory that all they ever care about are their intentions. Okay, so this goes back to the just war theory, where supposedly we meant to do well and okay, mistakes were made. But in fact, the just war theory has led us astray in allowing these people to continue to perpetrate atrocity on the assumption that they have good intentions. Okay, so we meant to do well is supposed to absolve them for everything. And that comes from the just war theory. That comes from doctrine of double effect. You know, so when you are undertaking a military mission, supposedly it's okay that you're going to kill some innocent people as long as, even if it's foreseen, as long as you don't intend to kill them, and as long as they're not a means to the objective you're attempting to achieve. But the problem is that in all of this like rhetoric, people have lost sight of the reality of consequences. Okay, so like, what have we actually accomplished in any of this? It doesn't matter what your intentions are, because on both sides of every conflict, the leader has what he takes to be good intentions. Okay, so this is a Socratic idea. It goes back to no one knowingly does evil. So from your own perspective, you pursue good. Now, you may be wrong, but from your own perspective, you're doing something which you think is good. So when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, it was because he believed that Kuwait was siphoning off Iraq's oil. So from his perspective, this is an act of justice. Okay, so then back to your question of how does appeal to just war theory provoke further war? The more we wage wars in the name of justice, the more we solidify this framework for other people to use. So then when Putin invaded Ukraine, he claimed justice. He said, okay, so I'm doing this because they keep bombing the people in the Donbass, and I can't you know, allow this to happen anymore. So we're all very disappointed that he did it, but he did it, and he did it under the rubric of justice, just as every leader does.
Yeah. Well, that segues perfectly into my next question. So in the book, you make the point that especially when it comes to the American military machine, a lot of our wars are kind of crouched in this language of humanitarianism. You know, we fight wars because we want to help people that don't have freedom, and because there are all of these people that are being taken advantage of overseas. And so we have to go and fight a war, or these people will never be free. I mean, that was basically how they sold Iraq and Afghanistan to us. And you make as an example in your book what happened in Kosovo in the late 1990s. Now, I was like 10 years old or 9 years old when that happened. So I have vague recollections of seeing that on TV. That was my first ever experience with any sort of foreign policy, anything. But until I read your book, I didn't even really know what happened in Kosovo. Could you walk us through what happened in Kosovo in the late 90s and why that shows that wars waged for the sake of humanitarianism and aid are oftentimes extremely unjust and don't actually result in people's lives being made better?
Yeah, sure. Okay, first of all, you need to know that in the Balkans, there was basically a free-for-all of killing going on for centuries. Okay, so there were the ethnic Albanians, the Serbians, the Croatians, and the Bosnians, and they were at each other's throats for hundreds of years. Okay, so what happened was Bill Clinton decided that he would select one of these parties out of the group, Slobodan Milosevic, leader of the Serbs, and claim him to be the biggest boogeyman of them all. Okay, so then what always happens is the assumption is time starts today. So Serbian leader Slobodan Milosevic committed an atrocity. Nothing happened before that. Nothing provoked him to do it. No, nothing happened. History began on the day he did that thing. And then we have to redress it. So the same thing happened after 9/11. 9/11, there was no precedent to that. There was no like reason for the anger of the terrorists. I'm not saying they were in any way justified in what they did, right, of course. But there was a history that led up to their anger and that explains what they did. So same thing in Kosovo. So what happened is he just decided to basically turn the Serbs into the evil enemy, even though, in fact, all sides had committed crimes, I mean, against each other. And they all had these huge histories of crimes, you know, like people in their family had been murdered by one of the other factions. And so it went on and on and on. And what was interesting about the bombing of Kosovo is that Bill Clinton and Madeleine Albright, the Secretary of State at the time, claimed that this was a humanitarian intervention. And the reasoning was supposed to be, oh, look, they don't have any oil. So obviously we're not doing it for oil. And we have no, there's no strategic advantage to our supporting, you know, the Kosovars. We're actually doing this just out of morality. So, but then when you look at the actual execution of the war, they dropped bombs from really high in the sky to avoid any danger to the soldiers, okay? And they didn't put any troops on the ground. And as a result, they killed a lot of civilians in supposedly carrying out this act, this mission of humanitarian intervention. So they killed convoys of refugees attempting to leave. You know, they're trying to get away from the bombing and they bombed them. So, and they killed, you know, all sorts of other people. They bombed the Chinese embassy because the CIA gave them a bogus coordinate. And so of course that caused a little bit of like, you know, international strife. They killed all these people who were entirely innocent. And so the pretext was humanitarian intervention, but more people on the ground were killed after the bombing start than before, in part because the soldiers on the ground were provoked to be even more savage than they were before because of the bombing. So in fact, it was kind of a sham. And, you know, one take on the 1999 Kosovo bombing was that it was actually designed primarily to rationalize the ongoing existence of NATO post-Cold War. You know, you might say, oh, NATO existed to protect us from the evil USSR enemy. Well, then the USSR dissolved. So then why does NATO exist anymore? Uh-oh, we better find something for NATO to do. We'll send them to Kosovo and carry out this humanitarian intervention. They also did the Libyan intervention in 2011. So, and now look what NATO is doing. You know, we're basically getting very close to a nuclear war, unfortunately. But there is something to that. The institutional conservatism, you know, the people who work in these institutions want to defend the institution itself. So they don't want to like lose their job. So just these very basic, you know, principles of self-interest can lead these military institutions to continue to proliferate, get bigger and bigger, and actually find wars to fight just so that they can justify their own existence.
Yeah. And I mean, just to be clear too, I forget who I was talking to. I don't know if it was somebody on the show or somebody off of the show, but isn't it true that NATO has like 5,000 full-time employees or something like that, all making pretty good money?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. No, they're very powerful. And in fact, you know, given their original raison d'être, they shouldn't actually exist. I mean, it's just like this boondoggle. And so at this point they're causing more harm. They're actually not protecting anyone. They're just causing harm. They're provoking conflict at this point. And so, but, you know, there are lots of forces driving this. It's not just the personal interest of the particular employees. It's also the larger MIC, which we discussed before, the military industrial complex. I mean, it's a big moneymaker. The death industry is the biggest moneymaker of them all.
Yeah. And it's scary when you put it that way, because it really is a death industry. One of the other points that you made in the book that was really haunting to me, I remember reading this section on collateral damage and everything like that. And what got me thinking about that is that you make the point that history is kind of always told from the perspective of the winners. So when a war is over, it's the people that survive that write the history of the war, not the people that have died, obviously. And oftentimes the people that have died are just labeled collateral damage. Like, well, you know, it's unfortunate that they had to go, but this was all, you know, for a greater cause. What's the problem with the fact that we never look at war from the perspective of either those that have died or those, as you point out in your book, that have survived, but that have lost loved ones that were completely innocent from any sort of responsibility or culpability in the conflict?
Yeah, I mean, this basically impugns the notion that wars are waged in the name of democracy. It's actually the opposite of democracy. So the people with the least amount of value in the war framework are civilians. And so they're expended as coin in these wars. And we never find out, you know, the truth of the war from their perspective, because they don't exist anymore. And as I said in the book, the soldiers who are harmed, who suffer PTSD, they're just discredited. We don't have to listen to them because, you know, now they're mentally ill because of their PTSD. And so the only people who survive are the ones who are not troubled morally by what has gone on. And so I analogize it to a case in civil society. It would be analogous to only listening when you have a person who's suspected of murder and you only look at the evidence from his perspective. Well, every person, excuse me, every person who is indicted on charges of murder, suspected of murder, nearly everyone claims that they're innocent. Okay, so if we only listen to the people who actually carried out the acts or were believed to have carried out the acts, then it would seem that no one ever actually committed murder. Because the victims are gone, they can't stand up and explain what happened, and so we would just have, like, the whole society would be a bunch of murderers walking around. If that's what the analogy would be, because we only listen to the people who prevail in the conflict, and it does, the fact that an army prevails in a conflict does not prove that they were right. It proves that they had military might. So unless you believe that might makes right. In other words, that moral relativism is true and there is no absolute morality. Unless you believe that, then there's something wrong with the whole framework, because there's no reason for believing that the army that kills the most people is actually the one that had justice on its side. And yet both sides claim that they have justice on their side. And at the end of the conflict, the victors write history, as you said.
Right. Another point that you make in the book after that is that according to the just war paradigm, a war can be justified if it is called by a legitimate leader who has right intentions. Now, I'm not quite an anarchist, so I do believe, I guess, in a minimum sort of government, but I have a hard time with the idea of legitimate leaders having good intentions. What's the problem with both of those assumptions?
Well, the one problem is the one I mentioned a moment ago, is that both the leaders of both sides claim that they're doing something right. It's almost analytically true. You know, you do something because you think that it's good in some sense. There's some objective you want to achieve, and so that's why you're doing what you're doing. So the intentions thing, that applies to everyone. I mean, it's, again, the Socratic point, no one knowingly does evil. Like, maybe you think that Putin is evil, but from Putin's perspective, he's doing something which he thinks is right, and he thinks that the West is wrong, you know, to have instigated the coup in 2014 in Ukraine, and he thinks that the Ukrainian government is wrong to bomb its own people. So these are, you know, distinct perspectives. They clash. They both think that they're right, and the other side is wrong. And so the intention thing doesn't resolve anything, because everyone claims to have right intentions. So that doesn't resolve anything. So then what about legitimate authority? And this gets back to why the just war theory doesn't apply anymore. We know how our leaders became leaders. They were elected through a political process. They were, you know, doing their job, you know, whatever, they were a businessman or whatever their job was. Some of them are just professional politicians. Eventually they rise to the level of being the leader of the land for whatever reason. So we have Joe Biden now, who doesn't even seem to have like his full mental capacities. And yet he has the power to command the U.S. military, including the use of nuclear warheads, should he decide that this is a good idea. So the legitimate authority problem is that nations are artifacts and leaders are elected by groups of people who gathered together supposedly to support themselves and to promote their own interests. But then in the end, the leaders have a power that is so vast because of the nature of modern technology that they can wipe out all of the interests of their constituents who gave them the power to do that. So it's really paradoxical. And I think it highlights another huge distinction between the medieval world, when this framework was championed by Catholic theologians, and the modern world, when it continues to be championed, and yet it doesn't really make sense anymore. So one point I make in the book is that it's not inconceivable to me that were they alive today, Aquinas and Augustine would oppose modern war, because it's completely different. It bears no resemblance to the practice they talked about. For one thing, I mean, even the most minimal difference here is planes didn't exist. There were no planes, right? So the concept of national defense could be conceived of on analogy to protecting the perimeter of your property. Okay, so you have a house, you hear an intruder, you get your gun, you get ready to protect yourself, fine. That was how they could conceive of, you know, territorial integrity and defense, because protecting the perimeters of the property of the country was a form of kind of territorial defense that could be analogized to the self-defense of individuals and small groups, families, for example. But today we have planes. So what happens is planes fly thousands of miles away and drop bombs on other people's property. Okay, so that's a completely different concept of war from what was known about in medieval times. So I think it's actually quite plausible that those astute thinkers would no longer support the practice of war today, because it's no longer carried out in a way that bears any resemblance to self-defense.
Yeah. Another point that you make along with the leaders is the nature of being a soldier in modern warfare. And we kind of have this image of the soldier as being like these very noble and heroic figures. And I have a lot of friends that are veterans, and a lot of them are way tougher and way braver than I am. And I mean, a lot of them sign up with very good intentions, thinking that they're going to go out there to make a difference in the world. And so I have a lot of respect for them for that perspective. But you say that in your book, the economics of the military, the way that they offer financial incentives to soldiers in the modern world, make them more like mercenaries than like traditional historical soldiers. Could you explain what you mean by that?
Sure. This has become more and more obvious in the drone age, where people are enlisted to serve as drone operators, and their position now is to sit thousands of miles away from the conflict zone, push buttons, and kill people. So it used to be that soldiers had to have courage to be soldiers. So in order to enlist, like your friends, you know, you would say you have to be willing to risk your life and you have to have the guts to do this. And leaders themselves, way back when, fought next to their soldiers. Okay, so these are two very big differences. Our leaders, they're sequestered behind bunkers. They will never, yeah, ever be harmed by their decisions to wield military force. Even in the event of nuclear war, they are the only people who have access to effective shelters. So it's really odd, because we still pretend like the leaders themselves are courageous, when in fact they, right, need no courage whatsoever to do what they're doing, because they're never at any risk. And now drone operators, as the military becomes progressively more automated, the requirement of courage is being removed from the job description of soldiers as well. I actually have an essay, which in a way I guess is incorporated in War and Delusion. It's called The End of Military Virtue. And it shows how risk aversion has led us to this point where we're automating war to the point where at some point it's just going to be people pushing buttons, and the only people who are actually going to be at risk will be the civilians on the ground. So, which is ironic, to say the least. So the way that this is all rationalized is in terms of this principle of necessity, where soldiers are supposed to obey orders, because if they don't, then they risk their own and their platoon's, the members of their platoon's lives. So that's how obedience is rationalized. Okay. So if, let's say you're in Vietnam, and if you don't follow an order immediately, then you risk not only your own life, but you risk all of your buddies' lives, and you risk the battle you're in. And then because you're risking losing the battle, you're risking also the war. But what's happened now is that the requirement of obedience is still there, even though all this other stuff has fallen to the wayside. So drone operators are asked to push buttons to kill people who are located in areas outside areas of active hostility. So there are no soldiers on the ground to protect. They're not killing people to protect soldiers on the ground. They're killing people because some anonymous analyst has determined that there's some guy who might have an idea in his head, possibly in the future, to carry out a crime against the people of the United States. Even though most of these people who have been killed, thousands of them, in places like Yemen and Pakistan and Syria and Somalia, thousands of these people are so poor that they actually could never make it to US shores. So we're just in effect killing people now. And that's why when I call it a death industry, I mean it quite literally.
Yeah. Well, and that brings us to one of the next points in your book, as we kind of get to the big conclusion of your critique of the just war theory. You have a chapter that's entitled The Moral Fog of War. And in that chapter, you argue that the nature of warfare overrides all traditional moral norms. Why is the idea that war can be moral just a complete illusion?
Because the people who are killed in war have nothing to do with the crime said to justify recourse to war. Okay, so again, and going way back to Saddam Hussein in 1991, let's say he committed a crime. Let's say he was wrong and he just decided to invade Kuwait just because, you know, not because of what he said, which is that Kuwait had been stealing his oil, but just because he felt like killing people or whatever. Okay, fine. Granted, he's a bad guy. We all know he's a dictator who actually was empowered by the United States, as a matter of fact, you know, through providing him with weapons throughout the Iran-Iraq conflict. He was just a schmo on the street until we, you know, gave him all this technology. And then he became, you know, a murderer and a dictator. But let's say any of these leaders has actually committed a really bad, grievous crime. Then the question is, how does going in and pummeling their entire population redress that evil? And the answer is that it does not in any way. So even if you achieve your goal, so for example, the forces of Iraq did withdraw from Kuwait at the end of the war, but then what happened was Saddam Hussein was still in power. And as we imposed sanctions on the Iraqi people, they died. So the people who died, the person who died was not Saddam Hussein. Throughout the period of the sanctions after the 1991 Gulf War, the people who died were children who were deprived of clean drinking water. Because why? Because we had bombed the water treatment facilities. So they had no access to clean water. And then we imposed sanctions, which made it impossible to purify the water and made it impossible for them to get medicine when they got ill from drinking the dirty water. So we killed hundreds of thousands of people. And so the question is, how can that possibly be moral? So let's say Saddam Hussein committed that crime. Okay, fine. Why did we go on and kill like a million people afterwards?
Yeah, it just doesn't make any sense. And then, again, I think a good counterpoint to that, too, is, again, I'm not justifying the Russian invasion, because I think Vladimir Putin is a horrible person. And I think that what's happening in Ukraine is totally evil. But he didn't go after the water treatment plants and after the critical infrastructure in the same way that the United States always seems to do when we invade a foreign country.
And it's horrible. And again, it comes back to this intention thing. So, you know, when Donald Rumsfeld was asked about things like the looting of the museums in Iraq after the second Gulf War, you know, he said, oh, stuff happens. So like we destroy these people's, you know, entire culture. Their museums were all looted. We, you know, reduce them to horrible levels of poverty. They had no access to electricity and water in many parts of the country. I mean, the place, we turned it into a basic wreck, and same for Afghanistan. And yet it's supposed to be like, oh, but you know, we had a just cause. That was actually one of the requirements of Yousad Bellum, just cause, which I didn't mention because it's tautological. I mean, everyone who wants to go to war thinks that their cause is just. So basically, and like the ultimate problem with the theory is that the person who has the prerogative to interpret the meaning of all of the other requirements is in fact the legitimate authority. So he says it's a just cause, therefore it is a just cause. He says it's proportional, therefore it is proportional. He says it's a last resort, and it becomes a last resort because he refuses to negotiate. So therefore it's a last resort. Oh, voila. So we have that going on right now, you know, with these so-called diplomats who refuse to negotiate. Like, why do we have a State Department at this point is my question. <It's> like, they refuse to negotiate. Yeah.
It doesn't make a lot of sense. And you also point out that war is completely antithetical to the ideas of democracy and universal human rights. Now, after the last 3 years with COVID and everything that's gone on in Ukraine, I'm not sure if democracy and universal human rights have a whole lot of meaning to our political class anymore, unfortunately. But to the average person, those two concepts actually mean something. And we think that organizations like NATO and the United Nations are supposed to uphold universal human rights and democracy and all of that. But you claim that they're completely incompatible with the idea of war. How is that the case?
Well, war is the ultimate expression of tyranny. Okay, if you look at the concept of tyranny and a tyrant, what a tyrant does is he can't persuade you to agree with him or to give up your claims, and so he kills you. He says, off with your head. So that's exactly what war does. War is a renunciation of any nonviolent means to resolve a conflict. So you've just decided, I'm going to go kill a bunch of people. I'm not going to listen to what you have to say. I'm not going to try to assess the situation, look at the facts, look at the best way to resolve the conflict. I'm just going to kill a bunch of people. And the problem is that at the end of the war, you end up having to go to the negotiation table anyway. So the only question for war makers is how many people are you going to throw into your meat grinder before you go to the negotiation table? Because you will go to the negotiation table unless, as in the current circumstances, you bring us to the brink of into nuclear war. Beyond the brink, over to nuclear war, in which case everything's over. You're destroying large swaths of society if you do that. All the people in New York City, New York City put out this PSA, public service announcement, saying what to do in the event of a nuclear war, which is so crazy. If you're in New York City and there is a nuclear war, you are toast.
Yeah.
I mean, you're like directly targeted by, some of the worst of these bombs, which by the way are many times more powerful than the ones that destroyed Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So people act like, oh yeah, we can survive a nuclear war. You need to do your homework. It's like,
Yeah. Our politicians and our leaders can survive a nuclear war because they have bunkers that are buried deep in places that won't be attacked.
Which is precisely why they of all people should not have the power to decide when to use these weapons.
Right.
The people who have the power, first of all, we shouldn't have these weapons, but we have these weapons. And so the only people should be the ones who actually have their lives on the line. It shouldn't be people who actually have nothing to lose, because it's another case where it's complete example of oligarchy, the oligarchic system we live in, of a few powerful elites who have access to means of protection which we don't have access to. And so it's really crazy that they should actually be able to make these calls, because we're the ones who are going to perish in the event of such a war.
Right. And I think that there's a general feeling in at least in the circles that I run, I feel like most people kind of instinctively know that war is not a good thing and that we should not try to get ourselves entangled in wars. But, my entire life, we've been at war with some country overseas. Mm-hmm. So why is it that people keep on supporting these wars over and over again, even though we continue to lose them? I guess a better way to put that would be, why do people continue to support politicians that wage these wars, even though we've never won one in my lifetime, and they only seem to make everything worse for everybody involved?
In a word, propaganda. So unfortunately, the Pentagon has a very large public relations wing, which is engaged in effectively nonstop propaganda, making it seem that everything they do is right and just, And when a few mistakes are made, they ascribe them to a few bad apples, or when I should say big mistakes are made, they ascribe them to a few bad apples. And they've really infiltrated all of our society. So everywhere you see depictions of war which glorify it, particularly in Hollywood, but also the way war is talked about on television. So you don't see depictions of the horrors of war on television. You only see, you know, the victories trumpeted. So propaganda is the answer. And I think that this especially became obvious since 1991, when they depicted the Gulf War as a kind of sporting event. So if you look at any of the film footage from back then, they didn't show any dead people. They didn't show any blood. They only showed some lights in the sky, you know, looked kind of pretty actually. So Americans have been trained to believe that war somehow is this sterile thing. And, you know, we're not actually slaughtering small children and terrorizing people. We're somehow achieving justice. That's what we're told. And this has been a magnificent feat of propaganda, which has been brought about because war is so lucrative, unfortunately. So it's remarkable that every single progressive, quote unquote, progressive congressperson voted to send $100 billion to Ukraine to pursue a war, even though supposedly progressives care about domestic problems. So that's a huge amount of money. That's the amount of money that could solve all sorts of problems we have in the United States. But instead of doing that, they're all in on the war propaganda machine, because, you know, the title of my book, War and Delusion, we want to believe that we are good and that we oppose evil. And it's very seductive, this whole framework that's been used over the centuries to promote war and to galvanize citizens to get behind their leaders, even when their own interests are not being supported. So they're not asking questions like, you know, what just happened in Afghanistan? They're saying, oh, we have to go after the latest boogeyman, who is now Vladimir Putin.
Yeah. How do you think we go about convincing people that war is counterproductive to all of us? Because it seems like it should be so easy, because the evidence is just overwhelming, at least in our American context, that it doesn't work. And yet so many people just, it's like you said, they believe the propaganda. So how do we go about convincing people that war is not a good thing for anybody?
Well, I think a starting point would be to hold the Pentagon actually accountable for what it has done and the money it has lost. Like, you could just start like with a basic question, like, what happened to the trillions of dollars that you lost track of? Okay, so like, we need to do an accounting. So they need to, the Congress needs to audit the Pentagon instead of just presuming that it's all good and everything it does is fine and it can do anything it wants and continuing to augment its budget. We need to have some sort of accounting of what they've done with all this money and whether any of the things they have done have actually helped us or they've actually made us less secure than we were before they did them.
Yeah. And we talked, and the last time I had you on the show, I think it was episode 15, we talked all about the military-industrial complex and about how it's worked its way into every aspect of society. And so to any of my listeners that haven't heard that episode, it's really great. You should go back and check that one out. Before I get you out of here, I got to ask you what's going on with the war in Ukraine. I had Benjamin Abelow, who wrote the book, How the West Brought War to Ukraine, on my show a couple of weeks ago. And at the end of the show, I asked him that, and he was very pessimistic. Like, he was not hopeful that things were going to go well for anybody in Ukraine and that we were going to be able to find a peaceful resolution. What do you make about what's going on in Ukraine right now? And what's the solution there? Like, how are we going to come to an end with this conflict?
Yeah. Somewhat ironically, I think the best case scenario is that Europeans actually call for an investigation into Nord Stream. And I think once that has been carried out, I mean, there's only basically one suspect. Like, right. Okay, so who else could do it? Right. It's not like, you know, shoplifting. Oh, anyone could have done it. No, not anyone can like blow up the Nord Stream pipelines. So we have a plausible timeline of how it happened. We have it. It's all been laid out for us by Seymour Hersh. And I think the Germans need to step up and say, yeah, this is completely unacceptable. And if the people of Germany defy their leaders and say, no, we want to hold, you know, we want to hold an investigation into this and find out what happened, they will withdraw their support eventually. I think that, you know, my best case scenario is that the Europeans stand up against their leaders who have all been kind of sucked into this NATO thing. I mean, like EU Ursula is like the worst thing that ever happened. Yeah. I think so. they're all in this like little clique and they've all decided that, you know, Zelensky is this great person, you right. know, when in fact he's just like a, you know, paid crisis actor as far as I can tell.
Literally,
so,
yeah.
So, it's like, really? I don't know if you saw Sean Penn. He like borrowed some of, you know, Zelensky's togs and went on television. He's wearing like camouflage and everything is right. promoting Zelensky. The thing is like, it's farcical yeah. if it weren't so dangerous. I should say it would be farcical if it weren't so dangerous. But I think the best case scenario here is the Nord Stream sabotage happened. It's a fact. It was done. It was an international act of terrorism. And if Europeans, you know, get their wits about them, there are a few people who are doing it. There are a couple Irish MPs in the EU, Mick Wallace and that other wonderful Irish woman, Claire, what is her last name? Anyway, so you know who I'm talking about.
Yeah,
the two
yeah.
Irish, the fighting
Twitter,
Irish.
Yeah.
So they are always up there saying, why aren't we investigating this? So I think the Europeans need to investigate this. And once they do, then they're going to put, you know, two and two together and say, hey, wait a minute. The reason why we don't have heating oil this winter, you know, why we can't heat our houses this winter is because the United States sabotaged the pipeline. Then why are we supporting them? You know, they're just like completely, you know, loose cannon rogues. I mean, we're a rogue state at this point.
Right.
This is what we're doing. And so I saw another feature in Der Spiegel. This will help in Germany. And even though it's awful, it's that the CIA has been stalking and like harassing anyone who supports Julian Assange. Okay, so if Germans get behind all of these stories and realize that, in fact, we're not helping them, we're actually harming them, then we could see them withdraw their support. And eventually, because their societies are at least nominally democratic, these people will be ousted. I mean, you can oust people at various levels, and we'll see some change. Another possible avenue offering some hope, as paradoxical as it may seem, is that Russia and China and Iran and everyone else we've been picking on could create an alliance, which makes it impossible for the United States actually to you know, wage a war against them without committing complete suicide. And I'm not like,
right.
you know, I'm not saying that won't happen because I like anything's possible with these people,
right.
but it makes it less likely, I think.
Yeah. What do you think would be the consequences for Joe Biden? Because, I mean, really, he's implicated in bombing like a UN country, right? Because he just, I mean, if
yeah.
he is responsible for destroying the pipeline, that's an act of war against an allied country. What happens
yeah.
to him after this?
No, exactly. I mean, you know, they'll just say he was mentally incompetent or whatever. he'll have some out, you know. Oh, yeah, he didn't realize what he was doing. And everyone would be like, yeah, I guess that's kind of totally plausible. Look at the way he conducts himself, you know. So,
right.
So he'll have it out. Like, he's not all there anyway. So no one really thinks he's running the show. The question is, who is running the show at this point? And it's a little bit frightening because they seem so hell-bent on just World War III. I mean, it's not like they're not satisfied with just provoking Putin. They also have to provoke China simultaneously and Iran simultaneously. And it really makes you wonder whether we have mentally unstable people running the show, because it doesn't make any sense. I mean, they must be so convinced of their own safety in the event of one of these wars that they don't care. They're playing with nuclear fire and they don't seem to care.
Right. Yeah. And it's just like, man, I don't know. These people can't be that stupid. But then, like, if they're smart, they wouldn't be making these decisions. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what it is.
They can't be that stupid, but they must be crazy. They're either like really stupid or they're really crazy, or maybe both, you
right.
know, VEO Latin. So,
yeah. Which, again, is why we should not allow them to make decisions about whether or not we go to war, because they're always going to get it wrong.
No.
Yeah.
No, exactly. And I mean, one initiative that's come up recently is this Defend the Guard Act, where people in the state legislatures are trying to pass laws which make it impossible to deploy the National Guard unless Congress officially declares war, because Congress has given over their authority, responsibility, and right to check the power of the president to wage war since 2001, since the 2001 AUMF. And look at the free-for-all of killing we've had ever since. I mean, if Biden had to actually go to Congress and say, should we wage a war in Somalia? I venture to guess that they would not eradicate it. I mean, Somalia is this, you know, hellhole on the other side of the world, and it's filled with people who can't afford to get to our country, even if they hate us. You know, so you know, I think that if Congress actually had to put their name on the line, we would not have this endless war.
Yeah.
So I think they really have to bring, you know, take back control of the war making powers as decreed in the, as outlined in the Constitution. Unfortunately, there are a bunch of cowards at this point, you know, like the progressive bloc. It's the fraud squad, you know, it's completely pathetic. Progressives used to be the most dependable leftist anti-war force, and now they're completely out to lunch.
Yeah. It's a shame. Well, Lori, this has been an excellent conversation. You have me completely convinced that the just war theory does not work. Before I let you go, just tell my audience, what are you working on right now? And then where can people find your work?
Okay, so my volume of corona-apocalyptic essays will be out soon. It's being published by the Libertarian Institute. It's called Questioning the COVID Company Line. Critical Thinking in Hysterical Times. To remember the title. Okay, so that's my thing. I always try to play, approach things from the perspective of logic and like, wait, what's going on here? Instead of becoming hysterical, let's look at the facts. You know, so look at the argument. So that book will be out soon. It's hard to finish because more stuff keeps emerging about COVID. It's like you think the story's over. You know, Biden said in September the pandemic's over. I was like, hooray, let's move on. But unfortunately, it's not over. It's not over until it's over. So finishing that up, I'm going to put together a second book on drone warfare because it was never debated and we have to discuss this before it completely gets out of control. It already is kind of out of control, but, and you know, I'm doing my usual essays at the Libertarian Institute. So you can always find me there. All my books are listed. If you go to libertarianinstitute.org, I'm on the masthead. You could click there. It shows all my articles and then on the side, all my books. So you can go from there. That's the easiest way. I do have a blog. It gets very low traffic. I think I'm on some Google blacklist. Like you can't even find my blog. It's like so, which I don't know. One person told me I should feel flattered, you know, that I'm important enough to have made it to the Google blacklist.
Absolutely.
So, but I do have a blog. It's called The Drone Age. And that's where I have discussed since the publication of We Kill Because We Can, drone related matters and warfare related to, you know, automation.
Yeah, perfect. Well, Lori Calhoun, this has been a great conversation. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you, Alex. Great talking to you again.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Protestant Libertarian Podcast. If you have any questions or comments, please reach out to me at theprotestantlibertarian@gmail.com. You can also find me on Twitter. You can follow me at the handle @ProLibertyPod. Again, that is @ProLibertyPod. And you can also visit me at theprotestantlibertarianpodcast.com. At theprotestantlibertarianpodcast.com, you can also support the Christians for Liberty Network and the Libertarian Christian Institute. Thank you guys so much for listening to this episode, and we will see you next Tuesday.